Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome. Oh, wait, no, hang on. I wanted to try something new. I'm gonna get all up in close here, and we're just gonna be like quiet and intimate for this final episode. I'm trying something different. I'm trying out my radio voice here. Please continue, Jamie. Welcome, everyone.
It's a podcast about movies and wine, and for those of you who don't know shit about one or the other topic, my name is Jamie Harrison Rubin III, Esquire. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I'm your movie guy, and we're here to help you, dear listener. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that Jamie loves, or sometimes a wine that Jamie doesn't know what it is.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Usually, we don't. We are not even trying today or for the last six episodes.
But we're like super not trying today. I can't do this. I can't do quiet, intimate NPR voice. I can't do it. I can't do it. I don't know what I was thinking.
I mean, it sounded good, but it doesn't sound like Scott.
Well, it's just, I've been spitballing a concept for another podcast, but it is not something that I could do co-hosting with you because my tone of voice with you must be a little further away from the microphone and always prepared for adversarial combat.
What, you don't think that we can be intimate NPR voice guys together?
No,
we're too antagonistic.
This is a disaster. I'm starting over. Today, we are on part seven of Jamie's six-part Court of Master Psalms tasting flight. Jamie, what are we drinking? Spoilers, I know and you don't.
That is very, very true. So for the last six episodes, we've been going through a Court of Master Sommeliers tasting flight, three whites, three reds. And we finished that last episode and we thought a bonus episode might be cool to do a wine that's actually blind. So I hollered at my good friend, Christopher Marcus, sommelier extraordinaire du Philadelphia. And he very kindly sourced me a bottle and wrapped it in tin foil so that I don't know what is in the bottle, and put a little tape on the cap so that I can't see even the logo peeking out. And he told Scott which wine to buy. And so Scott has an idea of what is in this bottle, and I do not.
I don't have an idea. I literally know what's in it. I know what's written on it. I've had some already. I just had a little glass while I watched Scorpio Rising again. I have more than an idea.
So okay. You've already been drinking today.
Yeah, I've had a glass, Jamie. I've had a small glass of whatever this beverage, maybe it's not even wine, is. It's wine.
It's definitely wine.
So thank you to your friend, Christopher Marcus, not to be confused with Christopher Marcus, the writer of like some of the highest grossing movies of all time.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah. Christopher Marcus and something else McFeely are the guys who wrote the Captain America movies and then the last two Avengers movies. Very, very, very well paid and now sought after writers of things who have not had much success since the end of those movies.
Well, I like my Christopher Marcus better. He's a rad dude.
I mean, I like yours better because he made a recommendation for a wine and also brought you a bottle so that I didn't have to, which is great. It's probably for the best because my only solution for getting you the bottle unmarked, because it's a Stelvin, and so that little screw cap had the manufacturer on it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure I was going to get the label off, and I've been doing some painting recently for a house project, and I thought I would just grab the last of a can of white spray paint and just spray paint the entire bottle and then deliver you that to guarantee no bullshit. But oh well. Well, so Jamie's doing a blind tasting thing and adding this as a bonus episode worked out for me as well, because there was one filmmaker who was always on the short list for my half of the miniseries, the Film School Classics, the iconic and foundational works of the Western cinema canon that I saw a bunch of times in my undergrad. That I've been not really pairing with all these wines that Jamie has been picking as he's talking about his professional wine education. And that filmmaker is Kenneth Anger, and he just passed away a few weeks ago as of this recording. So we're doing Scorpio Rising, Kenneth Anger's 1964 seminal work of underground American independent experimental avant-garde queered cinema. Scorpio Rising, the legality of being able to watch this movie is a little dicey. It seems to be difficult to track down on the VODs. It's not on any of the streaming services. There are currently multiple uploads on YouTube, but sometimes they get hit with like cease and desist or IP infringement listings. I have yet to be able to figure out why Anger's body of work is not available on the streams, except that, like, it's a bunch of experimental shorts, and I guess, like, Disney and Warner Media aren't, you know, tripping over each other to, like, pay the rights for them. You can watch them on the YouTubes, and normally I would be against that, but, like, I don't know, man. If the rights holders don't make things available to people, then, like, it's sort of the responsibility of people who enjoy the arts to, like, watch them any way that they can. Like, yeah. I would pay to watch this film if I could, but as of right now, it doesn't seem like I can.
Well said. I watched an upload that had Spanish subtitles.
Well, you just got to turn those off, buddy. You just got to turn the Spanish subs off.
They're in the video. There wasn't an option to turn them off.
There's no dialogue.
It was a sub for the lyrics of the songs.
I also watched the one that had Spanish subtitles in the title of the YouTube video, and I never saw a subtitle the entire time.
Weird.
Yeah. Maybe you're bad at YouTube.
It's entirely possible. I'm bad at a lot of things.
I'm definitely better at YouTube than you are. So that's probably part of it. Anyway, Scorpio Rising, 1964, Kenneth Anger. Check it out. 28 minutes long. Fucking weird. Delightful movie. We'll get into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jamie, do you want to crack this bottle open here?
I have cracked it open, and the glass has been sitting, waiting for me.
Now my bottle is chilled
here.
I'm brown bagging it here. I don't know if you can see this. We're doing some brown bagging just cause I didn't want to like get up to pour on camera
and accidentally
show you the label. I'm, you know, like a wino in the streets here. Brown bag and a bottle of wine.
Wino in the streets. Nope. There's a blank in the sheets joke there, but I couldn't get there.
Well, anyway, I'm not a wino. I'm not in the streets. I'm not going outside. The air is fucking toxic. We are recording this just a few days into East Coast smoke-ageddon that we are all enjoying and hacking our way through.
It's really wonderful. I changed my air filter yesterday. In my house, and I'm very pleased that I did that.
I cracked out two air purifiers, and I've got one on each floor of the house.
That's smart.
It is nastified.
Smoggy.
Yeah.
All right. So should I dive in and taste this wine blind?
I think we should. I'm gonna get ready. I'm gonna set a little timer here. I'm gonna do it.
All right.
Hop.
You tell me when to go.
Well, you started making noises, so I had to make sure that I could. Are we ready here?
I'm ready. You tell me when to start.
3, 2, 1, taste.
All right. So this is a clear white wine. It has a pale straw color out to a watery rim. There is no sign of gas or sediment. Tears are medium minus on the nose. This is a powerful intensity of aromas. This wine is showing clean and youthful. This is a fruit-driven wine. We're talking largely citrus here. We've got Valencia orange, ruby red grapefruit. There's like a Granny Smith, like a tart green apple. All the fruit is fresh and vibrant. There's a little bit of a yogurt kind of note indicating lees stirring. And a very faint minerality, I'd say like crushed limestone minerality. The other major component here is I'm detecting pyrazines. There's like a freshly cut jalapeno, green pepper thing going on, and some light florality, like lilacs. No evidence of oak. I believe that this was stainless steel fermented and aged on the palate. On the palate, this wine is dry, confirming the fruit-driven nature of this wine. The fruit is just slightly riper on the palate than it was on the nose. So that ruby red grapefruit is like grapefruit juice. It's got like an orange juice kind of character to it, and maybe more of a red delicious apple than a tart green apple. That pyrazine component, that like bell pepper thing, is very much present, and confirming that the minerality and the florality are both sort of background players, confirming no new oak. This is definitely all stainless steel fermented and aged. The wine is dry. It has medium plus to high acidity, medium alcohol, medium body, medium minus phenolic bitterness. The wine has got a moderate complexity. It is in balance. Initial conclusion, I believe this to be a New World wine from a moderate climate. Possible varieties include Sauvignon Blanc or Pinot Gris coming from the Pacific Northwest of the United States or from Australia or New Zealand in a 1 to 3 year age range. Final conclusion, I believe that this is Sauvignon Blanc coming from New Zealand, coming from Marlborough. We'll call it 2021.
All right. So, final conclusion. At the 3 minute and 40 second mark, you say that it is a New Zealand Sauvy Bobby from the region of Marlborough from 2021.
Yeah.
So, James, you were drinking the Kim Crawford Sauvignon Blanc from Marlborough, New Zealand, 2022.
Missed the vintage.
2022. So close. So close. Well done. Well done.
Thank you.
Do they applaud? What do you guys get when you get it right? Is there a buzzer?
In an exam room, they stay so stone-faced and they don't tell you whether you got it right or not.
They don't have like the lights from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or like the dramatic music from Jeopardy or
No, although I would be down with that.
That'll be one of your big changes if you make it onto the...
Yeah, it's going to be a game show.
Yeah,
who wants to be a Somalianaire?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Some wants to be a millionaire.
So, credit to your friend, Chris Marcus. One, he was correct that this would be probably very easy for you to guess.
Mm-hmm.
And two, do you know if he's a listener to the show?
I think infrequent listener.
Because I do love that he picked the one varietal of wine that on a recent episode
you forgot existed
and I remembered. So I'm going to assume that he's a big fan of mine and that he was just throwing a bone there just for me. So thanks for reminding Jamie about New Zealand's Zobby Bobby there, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
For picking something out and making it something that he had already checked was available in stock at my local Pennsylvania fine wine and good spirit store. So mazel. Thank you, Chris.
Mm. Every time I taste Kim Crawford wines, like we dunk on Crawford Sauvy Bobby a bunch because it's like it was one of the progenitors of the Sauvignon Blanc craze in New Zealand. It gets tagged pretty negatively among the Somme community, but there's a reason that this is like a benchmark for people and why people love this wine. It just is tasty.
It's very nummy. Also, Somme unity.
Somme unity, you're right.
It's not the commune. It's the Somme community. It's the Somme unity.
It's the Somme unity.
Which is also what you get in Jamie's new version where he's game showified the tasting portion and that you can play one Somme unity card to eliminate yourself or to protect yourself from challenges.
Jesus Christ.
I invoke Somme unity. You should really just turn it into like a shitty reality show.
Like a really low budget. Like cardboard set kind of.
Oh, I just mean shitty, like morally, not like financially, you know?
Well, yeah. Like consequences are like for getting things wrong or like you get dropped into like a pit of slime or something.
Yeah. And then like every 2 hours they pull you aside and have you talk to a camera and a producer and they try and like stoke the fires and make things seem more dramatic. And you have to constantly restate the dramatic stakes. If I don't pass this test, I'm gonna fail constantly. We're here to win. You might not know that because you haven't been watching this show, but we're here to win. We don't know about the other guys, but I'm here to pass the test.
I came here to succeed.
I didn't come here to make friends, all right? I'm not here for the Somme unity.
I'm here for myself. God, reality television's fucking terrible.
I've only seen one reality television show. I'm told It is an excellent example of all the things that are wrong with reality television, and I'm not interested in exploring anymore.
Yeah, that's fair. Mm. Yeah. This wine's tasty. I like this wine.
This is number. So there it was. So people dunk on Kim Crawford.
So Kim Crawford, along with Cloudy Bay, are like the reason why New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is as popular as it is.
I've had the Cloudy Bay. I've had it when you paired that with The Matrix.
That's right. And Cloudy Bay is super fucking delicious also. And like, for sure, there's very mediocre Sauvignon Blanc out there, but like, I don't know, it's good wine and maybe we shouldn't dunk on it so much. Like, I don't love that, you know, now it's a Pernod Ricard product and it's produced by the like millions of gallons. I don't find it particularly interesting, but as a glass of wine, it's delicious. So I don't have any problem with, you know, places having it on their list or with it being kind of a benchmark. And Kim Crawford himself has gone on with the massive multi-million dollar payday that he got from selling his brand, to Pernod Ricard, to go on to make some other really interesting wines in New Zealand, including some like really delicious Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir.
Thank you. I was waiting for that one.
I'm grooving on it. It's nummy. I like the price point. It was $20. I didn't mind having to go out and buy two bottles because I thought I was going to have to somehow deliver a bottle to you. I got an extra one. It's super nums. I'm imagining this with like a salad or like with some grilled chicken. It'd be super nummy with.
Be super good with some grilled fish.
I had it with some leftover pasta with like a nice like sweet tomato sauce. And that wasn't the best,
like, but pesto, though, it'd be super good.
Ooh, pesto would be really good.
Or like this is for me, this is like taco wine, like tacos al pastor.
Ooh, yeah,
super yummy.
I do love me some tacos.
I fucking love tacos. Just love tacos. There's this new-ish like breakfast taco joint in Philly called Taco Heart. It like this Philly guy moved to Austin for a long time to try to be a musician and ended up being a restaurant guy.
And of course he had to make tacos because he fell
in love with the breakfast tacos of Austin.
Right. Well, from the 5 days I spent in Austin a few years ago, I found it to be empirically true that the only type of food anyone wants to serve you in Austin is tacos.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. That isn't exactly my experience from my Austin trip this year, but I did eat my fair share of tacos.
It was tacos all the way down.
We did have a burrito with Fritos inside of it.
That's in the taco family. I think that still counts. Chris and I were like, look, when we were down in Austin a few, more than a decade ago. 12 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, we ate great. We had great tacos. They were cheap. They were delicious. Love all that fresh corn tortilla. Everything was wonderful. Good breakfast tacos. But like the last day that we were there, I was like, do you want to go get some breakfast? He's like, yeah, but let's not go with the Austinites that we're staying with because they'll just say, let's get tacos. He's like, I would like, you know, solid food, like something that maybe you use a fork and possibly a knife for. And the only options that we could find that admittedly were in like, you know, our price range was a Denny's, which we went to and was closed. And then another Denny's on the other side of town that we drove like 45 minutes to get to. And that was the only non-taco meal I ate.
You guys drove 45 minutes to go to a Denny's?
We were hangry, we were tired, we and were probably stupid. Hungover, and we were also probably high. So give me a break, all right?
Bad decisions that we made 12 years ago.
I mean, I would not go to a Denny's now.
Right.
But back then, I just wanted something that wasn't a taco, Jamie, all right? Give me a break, that's man. Fair.
I definitely would not drive 45 minutes out of my way if the options were tacos or Denny's. Like, that's an easy decision.
All right, but
I will be having tacos again. I'm so sorry.
Well, you know what? Only one of us has ever worked for Uno's Pizzeria Kitchen and Grill, okay? So I'm not going to take shit from you, of all people, about 11 years ago, one time I went to a Denny's.
Is the dunk there that Uno's sucks? Because of chain restaurants, Uno's is pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, they got all that soup that comes out of bags. I love the bags of soup.
Scott, it's so spicy. It's peppery today. Can I have some creamer for my soup? Oh, God. Oh, it's so spicy.
Who would put creamer packets in their soup? We're off topic.
For the record, dear listener,
no one's hearing this part. You don't need to explain
on.
It. I'm cutting it out.
I hate you.
Tell me more about Kim Crawford, a maker that you're definitely not prepared to discuss today.
I actually am. Like, we could talk about Kim Crawford, like, being part of the genesis of the New Zealand wine scene. But I think what I'd rather discuss today, since we're talking about the CMS curriculum and about what I find to be valuable, what I find to not be valuable, what I find to be sometimes problematic. Last time we talked about some of the things that I do legitimately find to be helpful about the theory curriculum. But let's talk specifically about tasting, you know, because I on previous episodes, I have talked about how I think that blind tasting has done an awful lot of good for me in refining my palate and in understanding how to assess a wine in order to create a wine list. Right, like giving myself specific markers and vocabulary for styles of wine that maybe are applicable for different segments of the market, things that maybe certain people are prone to ordering, things that maybe are within the public vernacular, things that are not, et cetera, et cetera. I think that blind tasting overall has been extremely positive for me. One of the things that has come to my attention over the past however many years is that for people that aren't raised in an American/European-centric household, for people whose flavor markers maybe don't include green apple, but maybe do include papaya, things like that, the blind tasting rubric and the markers that we use or that are accepted by CMS can be extraordinarily alienating. It's not a thing that was really on my radar to begin with, but, you know, people with a Caribbean background or people with a Southeast Asian background maybe would describe this wine completely differently from me, but entirely accurately. Right? Like, a thing that I didn't say about this wine was passion fruit, but I think that there's definitely passion fruit here. It's just not as much of a guiding light in my overall tasting experience throughout my life.
Yeah. It's not part of your formative palate profile.
Right.
It's just like why it's harder to learn languages the older you get. And easier to start when you're young because your brain is still learning new phonemes and it's easier to, you know, squidge all that info in there.
100%. But for what? Hundop. You're so stupid.
Hundop is good.
Hundop is fine. Hundop is more fun.
On literally the episode that is dropping tomorrow, you agree with me that Hundop is good.
I just agreed with you that it's
you
good.
You said it was fine. Fine is reluctantly like conceding something. Hundop is better than a reluctant concession. Hundop is good.
Okay, sure. Sure, Scott.
It's
your,
good.
Your addition to the lexicon is valuable and I like it.
Only my latest edition. Thank you very much. Please continue talking about papaya.
So for people whose formative years are spent eating things like passion fruit or papaya, those are the things that they're going to gravitate towards. And the specific rubric developed by the CMS and what you're graded on often doesn't have those things listed. And they're often grouped as tropical fruits or exotic fruits. The latter of those two descriptors is quite pejorative and dismissive. And so when we talk about blind tasting, while it has been valuable to me, there was a lower barrier of entry natively because I culturally align with the CMS, with the European/American palate.
Mm.
And there's historically been, you know, a problem with people who, you know, have different cultural touchstones where they might not say petrol when they taste a bottle of Riesling. They might say, you know, fresh pavement or something along those lines.
Or they might say gasoline because they're not British.
Or they might say gasoline because they're not British. Exactly. And so it's important that we like really examine the things that people are saying and with an open mind accept that maybe that all of these flavor notes are valid, especially because there isn't passion fruit or apple or grapefruit in this wine. It's just grapes. And everyone's tasting experience is subjective. And there's a way to be somewhat objective about these things while not being dismissive of other cultures. And I'm pleased to report that this conversation is ongoing within the Sommunity.
Sommunity, thank you. Yet another sterling contribution to the lexicon from yours truly. You're welcome, Sommunity.
We are forever in your debt, Scott.
Anyway, yeah. Subjectivity. Subjectivity, good.
It is. I mean, there's people react differently to things based on the cultures that they've come from. And yeah. I think it's important as culture becomes more globalized and as we all sort of are much more in communication with one another to understand what other people's touchstones are rather than imposing our touchstones on other people. Yeah. Which has historically been the way in wine education.
And in the West.
And in the West broadly. Yeah. Yes, correct. You know, speaking of the Western film canon, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was most of what I saw in school. We dabbled occasionally in films from Japan. Occasionally we would mention something from India and films from South America and Africa were all but not spoken about. And then it was really just about Europe, Russia, and the US. That was what we focused on. And unfortunately, that has like borne out in this miniseries. Like basically all the films that we've discussed. And like I thought about pushing back on it. I thought about going into some of the filmmakers whose works I have discovered. I have gone out of my way to expose myself to since college. And kind of forcing them in there, but like I that would be dishonest. Like I'm using this as an opportunity to talk about the stuff I was shown, and a lot of that stuff, you know, it's all white people. It's all white people all the way down, and mostly white men, and mostly white straight men.
Yeah, we could in the future, and you know, it would be nice, and I think I would love to, you know, do a counterpoint miniseries to this.
Yeah,
which would be like. The things that you and I think should be talked about more in formal wine and film education. But I think your choices were very much in line with what was going on my side of things. You know, It was very, very Eurocentric. And when it wasn't Eurocentric, it was America.
Yeah.
Because that's what gets talked about in like formal wine education. And there's so much more out there that we need to be talking about. As I was saying in our, you know, pre-show segment, you know, there is a ton going on with blueberry wine and hybrid grapes and co-ferments and aromatized wines, particularly here in America, but also abroad, that, you know, you can argue shows a more transparent or more honest view of the T word than vinifera, than like Pinot Noir from Sonoma County does.
I think we have to say T word now. It's been a long time. I haven't been bleeping any of the bleep words in like since we came back from hiatus. And I think we just have to start saying T word now. I think we need to destigmatize T word.
T word.
T word, which is taint, right?
That's exactly what I meant to say. Yes, yeah, taint.
Taint. No, he's talking about terroir. He's talking about terroir.
Terroir. But yeah, blind tasting, like it's valuable, but we need to think critically about it at all times and think critically about what people from other cultures are saying when they're blind tasting and not dismiss, you know, cultural markers, because that does damage. And incorporating those things into our lexicon does, you know, builds our vocabulary and builds our understanding.
Man, you have spent a not insignificant portion of this miniseries complaining about all of the shit that you are required to memorize for this exam. And not just that it's a lot, but that a lot of it is stuff that is not necessary for you to memorize. Like, you need to memorize it for the test, but is it actually going to be practical on the floor of a restaurant or a wine bar. No, why do you have to memorize all this shit? But now you're also saying that you should also expose yourself to and memorize an infinitely larger variety of fruits and produces and flavor notes from around the world.
Yeah, because those things are valuable on the floor of a restaurant. If I'm talking to someone from Southeast Asia and trying to like describe a wine to them, it's important that I understand what rambutan tastes like.
You don't know where, oh, rambutan? Rambutan is delightful. You gotta know what rambutan tastes like.
It's delicious.
It's a little weird.
Weird for us, but
I just mean aesthetically, like, because it's got all like the weird fringy hairs on the outside.
Sure.
And then when you get the thing spikes off it, it just looks kind of like a, you know, I don't know, what I imagine like a degloved testicle looks like. a rambutan's a little weird once you get it naked. It's somehow weirder without all the hairy spikes on the outside.
But we think it's weird because we didn't grow up next to rambutan trees. We grew up next to apple trees.
Yeah.
Apples seem normal to us.
I'm down with the flavor of a rambutan. I think that's delightful. I'm just saying aesthetically, it looks like something that there would be like a quick jump cut of in a Kenneth Anger movie.
Sure.
Between shots of bikers and shots of like Jesus in front of a swastika.
Yes.
Yeah,
For sure. But like, it, you know, those kinds of things I think are valuable on the floor of a restaurant. Whereas, you know, me understanding the specific aging requirements of Barolo versus Barolo Reserva, you know, maybe nobody gives a shit if it's 50 months or 60 months in barrel.
I didn't say it. You said it.
Yeah, I don't give a shit.
Okay, good.
But I do give a shit about relating with someone who's in my restaurant and who genuinely wants to engage and talk
about
the
people.
It's about the people, man.
It's about the people. You're here for the people.
I am.
People's Jamie.
I like that. Yes, I am the people's Jamie. I'm going to start introducing myself at the beginning of the podcast as the people's Jamie.
This
You're welcome.
My fault.
You did it.
I'm so sorry, everyone. I did this to all of you.
The
and
people's Jamie
to
is
myself.
Here. He's like the wine guy.
Half of our audience, those 12 people, will think that this is wonderful and they will love it. And the other half, when this episode drops, are going to be texting me like, dude, what the fuck? You just gave him that one on a silver platter. What were you thinking? Gonna get Dan. Gonna get Julie. Chris is listening now. He's gonna be upset about this.
Dan really likes it though. He'll complain about it, but he actually likes it.
The people's Jamie?
He likes my bullshit.
Yeah, but he also likes breaking your balls about your bullshit.
Right. It's
Dan,
both.
Dan
it's both
really
for him.
Dan's a problem for me. Dan needs to fucking pick a side, all right? He's been sitting on the fence. He thinks that the Jamie show, the self-aggrandizing, I'm an iconoclast, I'm Jamie. I spell my name with a pound sign, like bullshit. He thinks it's all wonderful, but then he also loves to break your balls for it. I'm over here
well,
living
the people's
my truth,
Jamie
being
is
honest.
Here for both sides.
Fuck. So annoying.
The people's Jamie is here for you, Scott.
The people's Jamie is going to get punched in the dick next time I see him. Awful.
Oh, man. Speaking of dick, I guess.
I mean, there's dick in this movie.
There is
some dick.
There sure is.
Should we do it? Are you prepared?
I'm ready to jump into the movie. And spoilers, I really liked it. I enjoyed the hell out of it.
What wasn't really sure because you've struggled with some of the because you like characters and you like narrative and you like things
yes.
that are fun, and this has none of those things. It has like
it has a little bit of fun,
glimmer of a hint of a narrative. And the soundtrack is fun and some of the people in it are having fun. But it's mostly like, I don't know. It's,
I mean,
if you're
they're
looking
largely
for like narrative, it's discombobulating.
Narrative is not what I care about as much, but like in a movie that has a narrative, I want to see characters. In this movie, you know, it's a musical montage.
Yeah.
Essentially
it's montage. It's collage a little bit. Like there's some crossover with the works of Kenneth Anger's contemporary and sometimes friend Stan Brakhage, who was like a famous collage filmmaker. God, we're not doing it for the miniseries at this point, but I should send you some Brakhage stuff, which is fucking crazy. Anyway, we should rewind it. Scorpio
yes.
Rising, 1964. Scorpio Rising. This is probably the film that Kenneth Anger is best known for, although it's not the thing he is best known for. We'll get to that a little bit later. Scorpio Rising is considered by some to be his most accessible movie.
Is Kenneth Anger his actual, is that his given name?
If you were to have asked him this, he would have said, yes, my name is Kenneth Anger, and he didn't want to discuss it any further.
Okay.
But no, that his birth name was Engelmeyer, Kenneth Engelmeyer.
Got it.
But like seeing a film by Anger or Un Film de Anger, which just looks like a film by Danger on screen, is like part of the brand. It's part of the mythos, or just an Anger film. Like it's, as he put on some of his films in the credits. No, great name though. Like were I to choose a name, I should hope to pick something as dope as Anger, as Kenneth Anger. But no, so it's considered by some to be his most accessible movie, which is weirdly laughable if you've watched it and you know, come to movies for narrative and for more conventional things. It's the second of his films that went all the way to the California State Supreme Court on indecency charges, which we will also get to. And it's an experimental, as said, borderline collage, non-narrative short film that mixes and remixes several of Anger's lifelong on-screen fascinations. Including biker imagery, the occult, sacrilegious use of Christian iconography, homosexuality, Nazism, 50s and 60s pop and doo-wop music, all of which is jumbled up in a dreamy, at times nightmarish, surrealistic montage that's reminiscent of Eisenstein, Cocteau, and Maya Deren. There's not much of a plot, so I won't begin to describe one. Jamie, what did you think? You liked it. You were down with Scorpio Rising.
Yeah, I mean, the soundtrack whips for like the it's they're all bops in there.
Yeah.
So for just baseline, you're kind of like bouncy, having a good time, but also like the people on screen are expressing themselves. I love the opening sequence where he's building a motorcycle. You know, there's a lot of like sexual imagery in using the tools and the way he uses the tools. And I thought that was really, you know, really cool to watch. I also just like watching people do things that they're good at. And the guy's obviously like knows what the fuck he's doing, building this, this bike. And then it moves on to like getting dressed and getting ready to go out. And that's super sexy and cool. And like, I don't know, the whole vibe of the thing is like, we're out to have a good time. And also, there's a bunch of irreverence involving, as you say, the Christian imagery and all of that, which I'm on record enjoying irreverence as it is, as it pertains to Christianity.
Yeah. And obviously you're also a huge fan of that Christian imagery being mixed with Nazi iconography as well.
Listen, I'm not opposed to it.
Truthfully, like, fuck knows. Like, I feel like as I'm watching it that I have a pretty solid grip on like what associations the movie is trying to like spark with you, right? Like we start on one of our two characters, such as they are, very lovingly and sensually assembling his motorcycle. And then that, I have to pull up the soundtrack here because I'm not off book on my 50s and 60s doo-wops. So that is largely cut to a song called Wind Up Doll by Little Peggy March. And like there's conflation and association between like masculine obsession with vehicles and intercut with like toys of guys on motorcycles.
Yep.
But then also it's an extremely feminine like romance song. And so we're conflating a hyper-masculine image with a feminine tone while conflating like toys and childish things with vehicles and also the vehicles with objects of sexual desire. And like, I feel like I'm tracking with all of that. And then by the time we get to the church and a kind of violent and transgressive, maybe orgy towards the end. And then the Scorpio character, who's like our second biker character who shows up, and we have like this long montage of him suiting up in all of his leather, and he almost looks like a biker cop by the time he finally makes his appearance. And then he shows up in the church with the Jolly Roger pirate flag and is like shouting from the pulpit while we see flashes of Hitler and a swastika and then intercutting with an actual motorcycle race that I feel like I need to watch it maybe five or six more times to like draw all of the various connective tissues together. Like it's very fragmented and it's not didactic, you know, like you can draw a lot of conclusions and parallels from a film like this.
Yeah. And it probably says a lot of different things to a lot of different people based on their experiences.
Yeah.
You know, I was, you know, thinking about the suiting up part of it all. That's coming right after something that is so traditionally masculine, right? Like building a motorcycle. And then the montage of them getting ready to go out, and like putting on jewelry, even though the things that they're putting on their body are quite, you know, masculine leather or whatever.
Yeah.
The sequence itself.
The jewelry is pretty butch and aggressive looking. The big, scary, chunky rings and the big honking chains that they've got on their jackets.
Right. But like out of the 50s and 60s, we've seen montages of women getting ready in much the, you know, like spraying hairspray and like affixing jewelry and getting the, like putting on a dress or whatever. It calls back to that kind of a thing. So it's like breaking down the masculine feminine thing. Like what is masculine? What is feminine?
Yeah.
I just enjoyed watching it baseline.
It's an essay film, but maybe one without a thesis. You know, Anger was not always interested in being over explicit in what he was talking about. And from what I've read, it seems like for him, he didn't always know what the effect was that he was going for until he saw it on screen.
Right.
Like I think he's an amazing image maker and the photography is beautiful and the incredibly stylized lighting is so arresting, but I kind of think his real skill is as an editor and the way that he combines the images and creates this montage or this collage sensibility. That is where all the meaning really comes in. It's in the associations between one idea and the next. Here, let me read you this. This is something Anger told Roger Ebert in an interview from, I think, 1978. He said, "Some movies can be the equivalent of mantras. They cause you to lose track of time. You become disoriented. Magical things can happen. Magic causes changes to occur in the universe. You can mix two elements together and get an unexpected result just beyond the edge of what you realize." And that's like such a perfect distillation of, like, going back to what we talked about when we talked about Eisenstein and the battleship Potemkin, like the power of montage. It's that alchemy, that combining two images or two shots or two concepts creates a third idea in the mind of the viewer. It's potent shit, man. Like to go from a group of like gay men hanging out, fucking around, goofing off, actually fucking possibly, like the cuts are fairly quick, to then intercutting that with footage of Jesus from, you'll love this. So the Jesus footage is from a movie that the Lutheran Church commissioned, a Jesus film that they wanted to show to their congregations, that according to Anger, and he was a bit of a bullshit artist, so hard to tell how true this is. According to Anger, there was a Lutheran church next door to him, and it was accidentally delivered to him. So he used that film and spliced it into this movie. And so we've got a song about rebels playing while we're intercutting between a bunch of like butch gay coded bikers going out and hanging out together and riding their fucking hogs and goofing off and mooning each other and then doing actual like sex acts with one another. Intercut with Jesus like healing the blind and the poor, and then him and all of his disciples like going in for what's probably supposed to be the Last Supper. There's so much you can draw just from that about the idea of being a rebel, about being a countercultural figure, about being like, you know, your identity being outlawed essentially in your own community. And then he brings goddamn Nazi stuff into it, and which confounds all of it. And then the violent imagery of the Scorpio figure, who is sort of menacing more than any of the others and maybe looks kind of like a cop. I'm not really sure. Like there's just a million different ways that you can pull things from this. And I don't know, like to compare it to something else that we watched in the season, like I was pretty put off by rewatching the Buñuel and Dalí film, Ancien Andalou, which I felt was like a lot of meaningless signifiers and bullshit. Like they're tapping into things, but they clearly don't have, to me at least, like it's very much on screen, their whole MO behind that movie, which is like, we're not going to unpack the dream imagery. We're just going to express the dream imagery. And like, it seems like Anger is doing the same thing. And yet I find his stuff simultaneously more provocative and less offensive than what is in Ancien Andalou. You know, like he's going for provocation. He's pushing boundaries in the same way that they were. But then there also wasn't like humor derived from sexual assault, right, as there is in that movie. And I don't know, maybe it's like my bleeding heart sensibilities leaking through. But like, I don't know, from the way he talks about his films, like he's not interested in just being one thing. He's not interested in just expressing one thing. Like he's been described as the godfather of American queer cinema, and he was not interested in that label. He's like, no, don't pigeonhole me. Don't put me in a cubbyhole. Like I am so much more than that. And like, yeah, I want to do my own thing. Yeah, it's wild and it's provocative and it's bonkers. And you, if you like this, you should watch more of his movies. They are all semi-legally on the YouTube right now.
I think I will. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed the watch, but also there, as you say, there's a ton that one can take from this. And I think that's the thing for me that is the dividing line between this and Buñuel Dalí. Like Buñuel and Dalí want you to not take anything or want to specifically not say anything, or at least it feels that way. And Anger is maybe saying a lot of things and open to all interpretations, rather than none.
Yeah. He leaves it all on the table and kind of lets the audience just walk away with what they want. And the imagery is all so loaded.
Like, right. There's so much. The Jesus imagery gives you so much to work with. And then you add Nazism to it. And it's like, okay, I was maybe thinking that we're talking about something positive, but are we now talking about something negative? Or is this totally ambiguous? Is the point that, you know, positive and negative connotations are in the eye of the beholder?
Well, and like both of those, like he was a huge provocateur. Like I can't think of too many filmmakers who, with one movie, as Anger did with Scorpio Rising, earned themselves lawsuits from both the Lutheran Church and the American Nazi Party. And you gotta think
the American Nazi Party sued him.
They sued him for defamation.
Come on, guys.
They protested screenings of this film. According to Anger, and again, bullshit artists, so it has to be proven. But according to Anger, they're the ones who called the cops to show up to one of the earliest public screenings of the movie. The cops arrested the theater owner who was exhibiting the movie, charged him with indecency. The judge or the court convicted him. It got taken to the California State Supreme Court, who overturned that conviction. But then simultaneously, the American Nazi Party sued Anger for defamation for somehow their association with gay acts or gay men.
Yeah.
Which is like, man, that is a real testament to how fucked things were in America and kind of still are now, that like the Nazis are like, you can use the swastika, but don't put it on screen with gay people.
Yep.
Jesus.
And that I'm sure is exactly what he wanted.
Yeah.
He was exactly that attention.
He was a raconteur. He was a firebrand. So here, let me just rewind it back a little bit, because Anger is a fascinating guy. He worked entirely outside of the American mainstream for his entire career, but his influence on the actual mainstream American cinema and the culture at large is kind of monumental. His first film, or what he considered his first film, called Fireworks, from 1947, he made it when he was 20 years old, and it's this bananas landmark.
What can I ask you before you go on? Why is it important to note that, like, this is what he considers his first film versus what other people do?
I think he had made one or two short films before that, but, well, first of all, those are kind of lost films. Like, they don't exist anymore. But, like, it's sort of like how this is the first film that he wanted to be remembered by. So, like, the others were things that he made when he was a teenager. They were very youthful. They were probably pretty amateurish. And those were not Kenneth Anger films. Like he wasn't even labeling himself as Kenneth Anger back then. He was still Engelmeyer. What's so Fireworks?
I am never going to internalize Engelmeyer. He's Angerstein in my head forever and ever.
But so Fireworks, which is, truth be told, is the one that I saw the most in school. Scorpio Rising is sort of like the masterpiece of his body of work, or maybe like one of a few masterpieces. But Fireworks is the one that I saw a bunch, because of its place in the history. It's 14 minutes long, black and white, explicitly homoerotic short in which Anger explores his own sexuality, sadomasochism, masculinity, and the United States Navy. It's the first explicitly gay American film. Like the homoerotic elements are not subtext. It's what the movie is about. And this was at a time when being gay in America was effectively illegal. This was the first of his films that was brought to the California Supreme Court eventually on obscenity charges. In that case, both times it was not Anger who was charged, but the theater exhibitor. And this one was settled in the theater and Anger's favor by the Supreme Court, which deemed that homosexuality was, in fact, a legitimate subject matter for artistic exploration. Who knew? The same thing happens with Scorpio Rising almost 20 years later. The guilty verdict on the obscenity case in that one, the California Supremes overturned it on the grounds of its, quote, redeeming social merit. So, like, these are two massive First Amendment victories in the United States that Anger is, like, right at the center of. All because some people don't want anything remotely gay to be depicted on screen.
And those people still exist today in 2023.
So you were very excited after you watched this movie to send me a link to a YubTub of a Lady Gaga music video.
Yeah, Judas. Right? Lady Judas. Gaga's Judas, which is like the through line is explicit. Like she was cribbing from Kenneth Anger or homaging him or whatever.
Yeah. It's actually a little bit, I was amused when I got that text from you, because it's like, yes, a music video. Anger is largely credited as inventing the form of the music video.
Really?
Yeah. So you'll love this. So the year after he makes Scorpio Rising, 1965, he takes a grant from the Ford Foundation to make a short film, you know, like, cause they were doing philanthropic works. He takes the money, basically spends all of it on other projects and other expenses that he had, and only had enough money left over to make a 3-minute short film. So he makes a 3-minute short called Custom Car Commandos, all three spelled with K's. Again, the dude always being a provocateur. And it is 3 minutes of lushly colored, gorgeously photographed shots of a dude in extremely tight jeans rubbing down a hot rod with like a feather duster, set lustfully and beautifully to the song Dream Lover, by the Paris Sisters. You know, Dream Lover, cause I don't wanna dream alone.
Yep.
And it's that for 3 minutes. And he essentially invents the music video. Like the Ford people were furious and there was a lot of criticism at the time. And a lot of people looked at that and they were like, short form, non-narrative, entirely like aesthetic sensual experiences sent to pop music. And then the fucking marketing people came in, and then, you know, less than 20 years later you have MTV. Yeah.
That's Kenneth fucking Anger, wild.
The ultimate outsider invents the music video. But his impact on like music and pop culture is maybe not bigger than that, but broader. The way that he uses pop music in Scorpio Rising should be awfully familiar to you as someone who has seen a Martin Scorsese film. Scorsese saw this movie in 64, 65, and then just a few years later released Mean Streets, his first of like a Martin Scorsese picture, like branded films, which uses pop music in the exact same way. He cites this movie as a major influence, especially the way that it not just uses pop music as a soundtrack, but the way that it uses pop music contrapuntally to underline something, to create a feeling, to, in the text of it or the feeling of the song or the associations of the song, to contradict or to draw another association. Like nobody was doing stuff like that before Anger. And then Scorsese just took it and actually made it part of the mainstream as part of, you know, how the new Hollywood, where they let the inmates take over the asylum, Without anger, you don't get Scorsese. Without Scorsese, you don't get Tarantino and anybody else who leans on their needle drops all the time.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Why is this the bonus? Why wasn't this in the meat of this miniseries?
Way to fucking put me on the spot, Jamie.
Yeah, I'm blowing you up, buddy. Like, you're really stressing this as, like, as so important for popular movies that we all have, like, relationships with.
Yeah.
Which is not a thing that we've heard a lot during this miniseries. You know, you didn't draw a lot of lines between, for example, Buñuel and Dalí to modern film.
I mean, I did. I've been...
But not as, you know, hammered home as maybe the Scorsese Tarantino that you're going for. I don't know. It feels like
maybe you just weren't paying attention.
It feels like you think that this is more important than some of those other movies. And I'm just interested in your reasoning. I'm curious.
Well, I mean, I was on the fence about including an anger movie for a couple of reasons. One, I'm like a straight dude. And I don't feel super authoritative or comfortable talking about, like, major queer filmmakers. Because okay. I just don't have, like, the fullest context for anger and his body of work and where queer cinema developed after this. And that feels, in a way, like, appropriative for me to be talking about it. And I don't – so, like, I kept putting it off. Like, I'm not going to do anger because I'm probably not the right guy to talk about anger. But then he died and, like, fuck it. I can't not talk about Kenneth Anger now, especially given the context of this miniseries. The other thing is that we didn't talk about anger too much in school. Like, honestly, I think I only saw Scorpio Rising once before picking it for this miniseries. The one I had seen a bunch of times – was Fireworks,
right.
his quote unquote first film, which is great, but like this movie's impact is, I think, bigger, and it's just a better film. And I was happier to pick this than to try and track down Fireworks.
Okay, that's all very fair.
And just like also like I like all the well, except for Ancien Andalou, I like the other movies that we watched before this more than I like this one. Like, I admire this movie a lot. I find it provocative. There's shit in there that's never going to leave my brain. But, like, all of the others, to varying degrees, I just aesthetically enjoy more. This movie, there are parts of it that I find off-putting and repulsive. And it's you know, the Nazi imagery.
Right.
Or a bunch of what looks like salad bar honey mustard dressing getting poured on a dude's genitals. Like, they're...
I think that was Dijon.
Oh, Dijon, Scott. Excuse me. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. My mistake, Jamie.
Pretty sure that was Grey Poupon.
First, you put me on the spot, and now you're telling me I can't identify my mustard derivative condiments.
Listen, mustard is very important to me, and it's important that we get it right. Mustard's
very important to me, buddy, okay? I'm the only person in my household who puts mustard on their hot dogs.
That's right? Weird.
Mustard is important. Tiny doesn't like hot dogs, and the child likes catsup.
I like ketchup and mustard on a hot dog.
No, that's a fridge too far. I'm sorry.
Ketchup and mustard on a hot dog.
No.
Yes.
Mustard and relish. No,
also,
ketchup and mustard.
Sure. The Chicago hot dog, Scott. Have you ever had a Chicago dog?
Is that where they put an entire slice of pizza casserole on top of a hot dog?
No. No,
no, but that's that, that's the works. That's your onions. That's some relish. That's like some chili sprinkled in there.
It's onions, relish, a sliced jalapeno, and a slice of tomato with mustard and relish.
And an entire roasted pork butt.
No, and also celery salt, which is the thing that ties the whole thing together.
Is the celery salt.
The Chicago dog for me, my favorite of the regional junk foods.
Is
the Chicago dog.
Huh.
It's
But I bet it's not even a hot dog. It's probably like a nice ass sausage or like a kielbasa or something.
No, it's a hot dog.
Hmm.
I don't actually know what the Chicago like preferred brand for a Chicago dog is, but it's a regular ass hot dog with all of those things, and it just is like this regional junk food that doesn't leave you feeling like you need to go into a coma the way deep dish does or a Philly cheesesteak does. I could midday have a Chicago dog because I was feeling a little peckish and then go to dinner.
I got to go to Chi-Town. I've never been there.
I like it. I like Chicago. It's good. Yeah. And I owe them a visit. I've got some friends there who've been complaining that I haven't been there.
Oh, I am Jamie. I have friends. They want me to come visit. Anyway, shut up, because we joke a lot about how I don't remember anything that you say on the show, but you have forgotten every connective tissue that I have drawn between the films that we have discussed this miniseries and contemporary cinema.
That's fair.
Because I have drawn parallels every single time to underline the importance.
It just, I guess it feels like you're hammering them home further with this, or maybe that just the names Scorsese and Tarantino resonate more with me than the other parallels you've drawn.
I think it's a little bit of that. And I think it's also that I find this movie sort of baffling, and I have less to say about the movie than I do to say about its impact.
Interesting.
Like, there's not much narrative to discuss. There's a lot of imagery. And aside from just like going through it and picking apart the imagery and the associations and the montage of it all and the connective tissue, which sounds like great radio for a listener, like, I just have less to say about the actual object than I do about Kenneth Anger in general, who is just a fucking fascinating figure and who, like a lot of film culture right now, is celebrating as he has just recently passed. And I'm not even done. There's more crazy ass shit about Anger that we haven't even gotten to yet.
Well, let's get to that crazy ass shit.
Well, we'll get to the crazy ass shit at the end. But like, since you're so enjoying and not at all nitpicking the connections that I'm making with contemporary film and popular film, this is like the third time he's come up, but Anger is all over the works of David Lynch. The psychosexual nightmares, all the leather, the use of blue velvet in this movie is explicitly referenced in not just the use of the song, but the title and the nightmarishness in Lynch's film Blue Velvet. You see echoes of Anger in the early works of Catherine Bigelow, like The Loveless, in the films of Nicholas Winding Refn, who made
Who Dat Ninja?
He made Drive. You saw Drive with the Gaz.
No, I did see Drive.
Drive is like straight up like what if Scorpio Rising was like straight, but like maybe secretly not so straight. Where like it's, you know, this like silent stalkerish type dude who's like obsessed with a woman but also really wants to fuck his car and uses his car as like a mechanism of violence.
Yeah.
And also like the way that movie leans on the soundtrack, like Refn has pointed to Anger as a big reference point. And just in general, like the eroticization and fetishization of cars, which has often been a thing in the movies, Anger made it less subtextual and more straight up textual. So like without Anger and Scorpio Rising or Custom Car Commandos, you wouldn't have John Carpenter's Christine or David Cronenberg's Crash or Julia Ducournau's Titan. Julia Ducournau made Raw that we loved and were repulsed by. And her movie Titan that won the 2021 Palme d'Or at Cannes is like a movie that opens with a woman fucking a car and then the car impregnates her.
Oy vey.
And like, that's a major work. And all of that wouldn't happen without Anger. But for all of that, the thing he is actually best known for is not his movies. It's a book that he wrote.
Really?
Yeah. So after Fireworks, he spent a bunch of years in living in Paris and working with like some of his favorite filmmakers and his inspirations like Jean Cocteau. And while he was there, he started writing for Le Cahier du Cinéma, which we've spoken of before as well, the French film criticism publication where the auteur theory was first published.
We've definitely spoken about this, and I absolutely have internalized that.
Well, let me just try this on you again and see if this jogs your memory. Le Cahier du Cinéma, because you nitpicked my you know, affected French accent when I said this the last time we talked about it. But so while he was there, he wrote a few pieces for Le Cahier, which were like the publishers and some other people who reached out to him basically said, like, what you're writing isn't essays or editorials. This should be a book. And so in the late 50s or early 60s, his book Hollywood Babylon was published. And then it was widely bootlegged in the States before it was, I think, officially published in the States in like 75. And it is this major work of Hollywood mythology. It's gossipy. It's a bunch of stories about early Hollywood legends and silent film actors and the golden age of Hollywood stars. And it's all stories that Anger heard from his like youth and lifetime living on the fringe of Hollywood. And I think it was his grandmother who financed his first few films, who was a costumer on like old Hollywood movies in the 30s and 40s. She would repeat to him all these stories that she had heard, and he turned them all into a book. When people would ask him, where is your research? Where did these things come from? He would say, oh, he derived all of that material from telepathy. It's all bullshit. Most of it's been debunked, but it's bananas, and it's so imaginative, and the prose is so lurid and quotable that the book was like, it's been published and republished over and over again over the decades, even though, again, it's all bullshit. Like here, I'm just going to pull this up for you. So looking just at the Hollywood Babylon Wikipedia page, there is an entire section on falsehoods. So here's some of the most exciting ones that are in Hollywood Babylon. The book claims that Clara Bow, who was an early silent film starlet, that she engaged in sex with the entire University of Southern California football team, including a young pre-stardom John Wayne, has been debunked. It also claimed that Lupe Valdez, a Mexican actress and singer and dancer from the golden age of Hollywood, was found drowned in her own vomit with her head in a toilet after she committed suicide by swallowing more than 500 sleeping pills. Wikipedia very succinctly follows this up with, there was no basis for this story. and then my personal favorite, just from this recap here, is that silent film star Marie Prevost's body was partially eaten by her dachshund after she died in her apartment in 1937.
That word is dachshund, Scott.
I'm going to say dachshund because I've had several glasses of wine and shut up.
Dachshund. It's a breed of dog.
I know what it is. It's a wiener dog.
Colloquially known as the wiener dog.
Shut up, Jamie. Hush.
It is appropriate if you want to pet a dachshund on the street to approach its owner and ask, may I pet your wiener?
That'll be the end of this podcast here, everyone. Muting Jamie. We're playing the climactic music because I just can't deal with this no more. And I'm really not joking. We're never doing this again. Say goodbye, Jamie. Nope. They can't hear you.
Goodbye, Jamie.
Take a full step back there, buddy. All right. Good night, everyone. Well, anyway, if you're like Jamie and you enjoyed Scorpio Rising and are subtly suggesting that maybe I left the films of Kenneth Anger out of this miniseries for reasons that you don't want to put a finger on, I humbly suggest you watch more of Anger's films. There are DVD releases where you can check them out. I'm sure some of them might be available at your local library. Or if you're feeling dubious about that or just lazy, like, watch them on YouTube and, like, I'm sorry, I would rather pay money for these things, but I guess I can't.
Well said.
Maybe I shouldn't advocate people watch things on YouTube. Is that advocating piracy? I mean, I didn't pirate it. I'm not trying to.
You are explicitly advocating for paying for it when you can.
I'm always down for paying for it. I only watch things on the tub when it's public domain or legally uploaded by the rights holder. Or in this case, when you cannot track it down.
When it's unavailable. And I'm sure that the reason it's unavailable everywhere is that it's, even today, scandalous. It's a little bit too gay, I'm sure.
My assumption was that it was the music. I just assumed that because it's wall-to-wall pop music and he was doing like experimental stuff outside of the mainstream with not much of a budget, that he just wasn't licensing things and that's why they're not streaming anywhere. But apparently Anger spent like $8,000 licensing all of the songs for the movie.
Could also be the dicks.
Could be the dicks, but then why would it be on YouTube? YouTube hates dicks too.
I don't fucking know, man.
I don't know, man. Like, look, I'm not expecting Scorpio Rising and Lucifer Rising and the other films of Kenneth Anger to appear on Disney Plus. Like, that's not what I'm looking for. Because those movies would end up being very short.
But like VOD...
Can't I pay for them anywhere? It's weird. I don't get it. I'm sure by the time this episode comes out, there will be a Kenneth Anger retrospective virtual box set and everybody will be able to watch them on VOD. And if that's the case, pay that money to the estate of Kenneth Anger.
Damn right. So does this wine pair with this movie, Scott?
No, this is nothing. I had a glass of this while watching the movie. This is not it's a pairing
not,
at all.
It's not anything.
This is nothing.
This is like light, bubbly, don't think about anything while you're drinking it kind of wine. And the movie is like
opposite of this movie.
Yeah. The movie is not even contrapuntal in a pleasant way. It's just like, it's fucking nothing.
Yeah. The movie is a provocation from beginning to end. And yeah, you need to be fully arrested and engaged with it. And yeah, I don't want to dull those sensibilities. This is nothing. This doesn't work at all, but is a blind tasting well paired with this movie. Cause I will say essentially like for this film in particular, like unless you did research ahead of time, it was essentially a blind viewing for you as well, right? You had no idea what you were getting into.
No, you told me that it was going to be like mostly music and montage, but that was the most prep that I got. Oh, and that it was a queer filmmaker.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in that way, sort of, kind of, even if I had been prepared, it would challenge me intellectually, which blind tasting does.
Do you enjoy blind tasting? Like, I know you do it for training and for practice and that you have to do it for the exam, but is it an experience that you enjoy?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like anything that you like set your mind to get good at. There's joy in the success, and there's joy in the learning and adapting. And specifically, like, I like tasting wine and tasting it in an analytic way, and removing the label allows you to be fully analytic about it. There's no preconception about what it should be or what it could be. It's just, this is liquid in a glass. Do you like it or nah?
Yeah. It's not a parallel I thought of before, but I was thinking that like, well, all right. So this is a blind tasting for you. And this movie was kind of a blind viewing for you, but honestly, like at least for this miniseries, most of them have been blind viewings for you.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of context. It's not like when we picked Tenet that, you know, like you don't have the background with Christopher Nolan that you do with like Kenneth Anger, right?
Right.
It just, the parallel makes me think about when, like, it happened sometimes in my film courses, but honestly, it mostly happened with when I would attend like a film festival. And sometimes like something just works out for your time slot. Like, oh, I was going to get lunch here, but you know what? I'll just stay in the theater and I'll go see the next movie. And maybe I won't even read the synopsis. It works out and I've got 2 hours to kill, so I'll just watch it. And like the experience of seeing something with no trailers, no poster, no synopsis, you haven't read any reviews, you don't know the body of work, and you're just going in blind is so refreshing.
Yeah.
It's not to say that it makes the movie better, but that like to remove any sense of expectation or anticipation from the experience is so refreshing.
I fully agree. And that's one of the reasons why I enjoy blind tasting, that you just don't have expectations. You're not burdened by knowing what the price of the bottle is on the shelf. You're not burdened by knowing where it comes from and the expectation of wine from that area or even wine from that grape. And it just like is a thing in a glass.
Price is an interesting comparison. Because if I find a counterpoint or a parallel to that in my world, it would be runtime. To go into something without knowing the runtime, because that's something that you can be conscious of. Like we, in our pre-show segment, we talked about the Spider-Verse,
right?
Across the Spider-Verse. And that I, without even needing to look at a clock or my phone or whatever, I have a pretty good sense of time, which has probably been honed by a lot of time spent not looking at my phone or at clocks, right, in dark theaters. And with that movie, like I could sense like, oh, this movie's 2:20 and we're coming up on 2:10. Like, why are we not wrapping shit up? But the last time I saw something like basically blind.
Yeah. I think that's actually a pretty decent analog to price in wine. At least as we're speaking of like the experience of tasting or watching something totally blind.
Well, because like price sets a level of expectation for you of quality.
Uh-huh.
If you know and you complexity. Spend, I don't know, $30 on a glass, you're going to have some kind of level of like, well, it better be this good or.
Right.
Yeah.
I admit it should have this level of complexity, or it should like be showing whatever, what, you know, and all different types of metrics that I'm looking for. But if you erase that, neither am I going to be forgiving slight flaws because I know that it's $15, nor am I going to be expecting great heights because I know that it's a $200 bottle.
Yeah. I like your blind tasting situation. If I was someone who drank more wine, I might be more inclined to just like test the waters there. But also, again, basically every glass that we do for this show is a blind tasting for me.
Right.
Because I don't know anything at all.
That sounds nice. I want to not know anything.
Jamie, you might have part two of your exam coming up pretty soon. I feel like you don't want to not know anything. You've been studying so hard. You've been working.
Just like experiencing life without context.
Yeah, but no, that's stupid. That's dumb. That's dumb.
I know, it's bad.
I'm sure you've had people say to you, like, wouldn't it be nice to just like drink the glass and turn your brain off and enjoy it? Like, no, like you actually enjoy it more than those people do. Like it's true. Patronizing and pejorative to say that to them, but it's true. You enjoy it more than that.
Enjoy it differently for sure. And more or less, I don't know, maybe. Do you, I mean, I guess, yeah, by those metrics, you enjoy movies more than the average.
I mean, that's insulting and rude, and we should never be elitist like that in any way. I will say that I...
Maybe not more qualitatively, but more quantitatively.
Yes, there right? are more things for me to enjoy when I go to the movies than for the general public to enjoy when they go and see the exact same movies that I do.
Right.
Right. There are just things that I am tuned into that they are not tuned into.
Which is the same with wine and, right. and myself.
And that's a double-edged sword because it means that while they're enjoying the more superficial elements, right, where they're enjoying the plot and the tone and the characterization and dialogue and music and adventure and whatever, like those things could be working for me, but problems with structure or aesthetic or semiotics will bother me more and will take me out of a thing.
Yeah.
I found that I'm incredibly sensitive to structure lately and that like structural problems really start to bother me. Like, why is the goddamn second act so long? Like we don't have to have three act structure every time, but when you're going for three act structure, the second act should not be an hour and 20 minutes long. What are we doing here, everybody? What are we doing?
Yes. Yeah, yes. I resonate with that.
Yeah. So yeah, not more, but more things to enjoy, but then also more things to not enjoy. To not enjoy, yeah. It's a problem. It is the problem of quote-unquote expertise.
Yes. Yes, yeah. It is.
Well, I feel like that's a great place to end things on.
It sure is. Yeah. And we've got a new miniseries coming up next.
We do.
Dear listener, Scotty, would you care to give us the rundown on what that mini is going to be?
So the next miniseries is something I've been percolating forever, and it is called Comfort Food Movies. This will be our first miniseries with guests. We're going to start with me and Jamie taking turns talking about our comfort food movies. And the idea is movies that are comfort food for you. Not necessarily movies that are comforting for everyone, but the things that you return to in times when you need comfort. A movie that is familiar, a movie that you know inside and out, or something that was there for you in a bad time in your life, or that reminds you of safety, or just something that the rhythms and the content of it like kind of ground you and feel good. So it's sort of like parentheses weird comfort food movies. So we're going to start off with a couple from me, and then we'll do an episode on Jamie's comfort food movies, and then we're going to bring in a handful of guests, friends of mine and or ours from the general film and film adjacent industries. And we're going to take it from there. So no spoilies on what we're doing next time, but we'll post it on the inters before that episode drops. And yeah, tune back in. Comfort food movies over the summer.
I'm excited, personally.
I'm looking forward to doing something different.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you.
It is always a pleasure. Please, if you're inclined, follow us on the socials. Our tag is the same everywhere. It's at Bigger Bottle Pod. You can find us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Tim Tams, otherwise known as TikToks or TikTok. And please make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com should you have any questions, concerns, comments, or if you'd like a review read on air posted from outside the United States, which would not be visible to us within the United States.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That would be me. Our art is by Ross Connard. Thank you so much, Ross. And also special thanks to Rebecca McCracken for helping out with the social media and project management.
Remember, everyone, drink more New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc and watch more experimental queer cinema. It's good for you, we promise.